Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Showcase Studio here on Michigan Avenue, and we are here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Two for Tuesday requests, too. If you want to get in there, it's one artist, two songs. Get your requests in now, two for Tuesday. That's 312-981-7200. We're going to be talking about celebrity endorsements and all kinds of fun stuff like that coming up a little bit later on. But right now, I want to welcome to the show a really interesting guest. She's an archaeologist, and she has a blog where she explores food-related history by recreating recipes from ancient civilizations. Feral Monaco is her name, and we want to talk to her about this really fascinating thing that she does. So let's bring Feral onto the show. Feral, welcome to the show.
Hi, Nick. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. So what made you interested in exploring the food that Romans and like other civilizations like that ate?
That's a great question. Let's see. I've been focused on like the archaeology of food in the Roman Mediterranean for quite a number of years. And that initially involved a great deal of like, study and research into like physical remains, things like ceramics or cooking technologies like ovens and grape presses or olive presses. The ceramic end of it is things like amphorae, which are huge food transport vessels that the Romans used to ship their foodstuffs all over the Mediterranean. And so I studied those for quite a long period of time. But what I noticed was that in studying these objects or potsherds, for example, it always leaned towards quantifying things like counting potsherds in order to try and draw broader meaning out of it, such as social relationships or like gender roles, you know, in the house or the kitchen or economic relationships, for example. Mm. But I kept thinking about the food itself, and I wanted to know more about the food, more about the sensory aspects, and like, what was the preparation process like? What did this bread that I see represented, you know, at Pompeii or in frescoes, what did it actually taste like? How long did it take to make? Why did people like it so much? Like, why was it represented so much in the pictorial record? So I decided that I was going to dig in a little bit more and apply some of the artifacts from the archaeological record, such as the technologies like the ovens and the mortars and the bowls, and then use the frescoes, which is a pictorial record, with the written record, which is like Latin writings of Cato or Columella or Pliny the Elder, to create these recipes in an attempt to try and understand what the Roman flavor profile was like.
Mm. Oh, that's fascinating. Well, first of all, let's get back. Let's get into your background. Feral, how did you start out? I mean, what interested you in archaeology? Was it something that you were interested in as a kid as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All my life. I wanted to be an archaeologist since I was a kid. And I'll be perfectly honest, I'm not going to lie. The first time I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark, I was completely sold. That was it. I decided when I was, I don't know, 8 or 9, that was it. I was going to be an archaeologist.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I sidelined it for quite a few years, and then I went, I started to study it, and I figured that, yeah, this is absolutely where I want to be. And there's always the old assumption that, you know, the world is picked over or there isn't enough work in it, but that doesn't even matter. I mean, the world is not picked over. There's so much left to explore, and there's still so much left to interpret from all of this and to learn from it, because this is about us. It's about human beings. It's about our past. It's about our behavior. The discipline itself is fascinating, and there's still so much to explore. And then for me, I mean, I'm a foodie and a food lover, and I cook every day at home. The study of food itself to me is fascinating because that tells us everything about ourselves. Like we know how much food means to us now in the modern day, in the modern era. Yeah, so if you go back and you look at how food was represented in the Roman context, for example, it was just as important to them. Mm. Like if you consider, I always think about this, you know how you look at, you know, Facebook and you see somebody put a picture of their lunch up, right?
Right.
That's what these Pompeian frescoes are. it's the food that they loved, and it's the food that they valued, and it's the food that they aspired to serve. So they painted them on the walls of their homes, or, you know, in the thermopolia in the restaurants, right? It was basically saying, this is who I am, this is what I love, this is the food I eat.
You know, it's interesting that, you know, you've always wanted to be an archaeologist. When did the food aspect get in there? When did that start to happen for you?
A couple of years ago, actually, because I was very interested in researching Roman trade routes, marine trade routes, and the food ways, how the city fed itself. I did a lot of research into the port systems. Pozzuoli and Emporium and Portus Tiberinus, which are the river ports inside the city of Rome, mm-hmm. because I was interested in how the city sustained itself and fed itself. And I mean, it was a complicated network. That's initially, you know, that's initially how they were able to choke off the city towards the end of the empire, was cutting off the food supply at those ports. But honestly, I worked at Pompeii last year with the Pompeii Food and Drink Project. The year before that, I was at Monte Testaccio studying the olive oil trade. And my mind kept wandering. It kept going to, you know, this olive oil must have been fantastic. What did it taste like? And Pompeii, I mean, if anyone that walks through Pompeii can see those restaurants and see the ovens and the homes and the hearths and whatnot, and see how central food was to their lives. And I became more curious about that missing aspect, because within archaeology, with, you know, Roman archaeology, we only have the non-organic remains. We only have the ovens, the ceramics. On occasion, we have the carbonized remains of some, you know, grape seeds or olive pits, or that type of thing. But I was really, really interested in actually exploring the sensory aspect of it. What was it that they experienced when they prepared their food and consumed it?
Mm-hmm. And so how did you go about researching this, you know, to learn about these techniques from all those years ago?
Well, I drew on many sources. We have the archaeological record, again, looking at the objects that were used, like bowls or mortars, that kind of thing. The Latin written record is fantastic. Pliny the Elder did some fantastic writing on bread making, for example. And he wrote out, you know, this is how you make this flatbread, and this is how you make unleavened bread. Here's how you make your own bread starter. And so I got into reading about that. Of course, they never really supplied measures or quantities, so there's a fair bit of freedom in there to actually kind of experiment with it and arrive at a conclusion with respect to, you know, how much water you would have needed, how much honey or how much cheese you would have needed, for example. The pictorial record for me is integral. That is the representation of food in art. So frescoes, reliefs on sculptures, and even coins. You'll see food represented on coins or even epigraphy at Pompeii, menus that are scratched onto the walls. That tells you what their food looked like. And that gave me an idea as to how to shape the food or form it. And then, of course, I do a fair bit of reading, of scholarly writing publications, other academic publications with people who've done a lot of translation. For example, Sally Granger and Christopher Grocock did a wonderful translation, a critical translation of a very well-known Roman cookbook that's a collection of recipes that we think might be by a man named Apicius, or it's an Apician collection of recipes that dates to about the first century AD. Wow. So they broke it down. They had the Latin and the English, and they broke it down quite beautifully so that you could actually pick it apart and be as precise as possible. But there's still that flexibility in there because there's some uncertainty with respect to some ingredients and quantities.
Wow. Wow, that is just fascinating stuff. So let's talk a little bit about the food. What are some of the good, the bad, the weird recipes? What are some of the things that you discovered and that you've made?
Among the good, I'd say one of my favorites is Columella's fresh cheese. Mm-hmm. Have you ever made ricotta before, Nick?
I have, yes.
Okay, so you know how easy it is to make that.
Yes.
So Colamello wrote in his writings about how to make a simple cheese by separating the curd and the whey. But they didn't have access to lemons or any citrus, so they used animal rennet, which is animal stomach acid, and it's not something that I was interested in trying to procure or handle.
Right.
So he said that's the bit of the gross out factor.
Right,
in there,
right.
He suggested that if you didn't have animal stomach acid on hand, you can do it with fig rennet, and it's sap that comes from the base of the fig when you cut it off of the tree. So I went into my backyard. We live in California, and I had some fig trees in the backyard, and I thought, well, let's give it a go. I mean, this sounds kind of wacky, but let's see if it actually works. So I cut a few figs off, collected a couple drops of the white, bitter sap into a little dish, brought it in, dropped it into my boiling whole milk, and separated.
Wow.
It was perfect.
Wow.
It made a beautiful, fresh cheese. I tasted it. It had a tiny little bit of a bitter undertaste to it, but that's to be expected. And I did do some reading before I did it, though, to make sure that I didn't poison myself, because the Romans weren't exactly savvy when it came to what would poison you and what wouldn't.
Okay.
So I was careful about that before I consumed it, and I lived, and it was great.
Wow, that's fantastic.
That was one of my favorites.
That's interesting that they didn't have, so no access to citrus at all. Wow.
But I believe that they had some access to it, but it was something that was exotic and elite. The rich people would have had more access to it coming from the Eastern Mediterranean, but I believe it wasn't until the Arab expansions that lemons were planted more along the coast in Italy.
Wow. Okay, so what are we talked about that. That turned out good. The cheese turned out good. What else have you made?
Let's see. Some of the weirder recipes. One that I made recently is it's called Moretum, and it's like a Roman cheese salad. You mix greens and you mix this fresh cheese, or you mix an aged cheese together. It's kind of like a Christmas cheese ball, Nick, except it's 2,000 years old. And so, but what's interesting is one of the recipes that I did, I used a poem from Virgil, which was beautiful. I got really sucked into it because I thought it was such an incredible poem to read. 2,000 years old, describes the life of a lonely farmer who lives in a small hut with his servant. And he gets up in the morning and he slaves over making his breakfast. And his breakfast is a ball of maretum, a cheese and herb ball, with a flatbread that he bakes on his hearth. And so he talks about going into his grain stores and unlocking it, because you had to keep it locked because grain was really valuable at the time. That was your primary food source.
Mm-hmm.
And then using a mortar, or going out into his garden to get his herbs and to get 4 bulbs of garlic. And then he comes into the house and he puts those 4 bulbs of garlic into the mortar, mashes it up, and adds in his cheese. And I read this and I went, this can't be right.
Mm.
This is absurd. 4 heads of garlic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, I'm going to stay true to form, and I'm not going to modernize this in any sense at all. And I put in 4 bulbs of garlic, put it in with my cheese, my herbs, baked the flatbread out in my ceramic oven in the backyard. And then I sat down to try it, and I thought, okay, this can be interesting. But it was actually quite great.
Oh,
it
really?
Was quite good.
Yeah.
That's really hot, like really, really hot. The garlic was dominant, but it was quite good. And I finished the whole thing in a couple of days.
Wow.
I was really impressed.
That's great.
I thought the garlic would be excessive, but it was fantastic. Yeah.
Wow. That's great. All right, Farrell, hang on, okay? Farrell, hang on. We have to take a break. Farrell Monaco is with us. She is an archaeologist, and she explores food-related history and recreates recipes from ancient civilizations. And we've got a lot more to talk about, and we'll get some more weird and interesting recipes and aspects to ancient Roman cooking. That's all coming up right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Showcase Studio here on Michigan Avenue. My guest right now is archaeologist Farrell Monaco, And she has a blog where she explores food-related histories and recreates recipes from ancient civilizations. It's really fascinating stuff. And we've been going over some of the good, the bad, and the weird recipes that she has recreated from ancient times. And we welcome Farrell back to the show. Farrell, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's get back to some of these recipes. Some fascinating stuff. What are some of the other things that you made that maybe weren't so good?
Okay. There's a component to Roman cooking which is very interesting, and it's the butt of a lot of jokes, but it's actually quite good if you use it in moderation. It's called garum, and it's a fermented fish sauce. Mm. It's essentially, so it's highly salted and it's fermented, and it's essentially like a MSG for Roman food. But they would have made this stuff out in the open, out in the sun, steeping away for weeks on end, fish guts and water and salt and whatnot. So I can't imagine that it smelled good.
Yeah.
And so I was cooking with it recently when I was making my pork manutol recipe, because it calls for it. And I knew that this stuff was going to be interesting, we'll say. And so I was cooking with it, and I was trying to figure out the quantity, because I didn't know how much to put in there. I didn't want to overpower it with too much fish sauce. And so I had to taste it, because I had to figure out, you know, how salty is this, how much do I need to put in. And I remember texting Ken Albala, my teaching colleague, the fellow that I'm teaching the workshop in Rome with, and saying, this stuff smells wretched. And he said, no, it's fantastic. Just taste it. You'll love it. And I said, it smells horrible. And he said, no, trust me. Once you put it in the mix, it's going to be fine, right? And he was right. But when you think about how it's made, or how it was made in an ancient context, much, you know, nowadays I imagine that, you know, they make it in parts of Asia. They probably have food safe, so it's much safer. But I ended up about a week later tipping the bottle over in my fridge and having to clean it up, and that was quite amusing.
Oh, no.
It was a disaster.
Oh,
I remember,
man,
cursing. It was a disaster. Oh. But it's nothing nearly as alarming as some of the other food that Romans ate, because they weren't afraid of anything. They used absolutely every part of the animal, and they weren't afraid of eating what they could get their hands on. Some of the territory that I'm afraid to go into, but I will eventually. I'm going to have to take one for the team. They prepared brains. They prepared rodents called dormice. They were stuffed, and you would stuff them with forcemeat or ground meat and herbs, and you would fry them. They also prepared cow's udders and testicles.
Oh,
they
boy.
Would roast and stuff testicles. Yeah. And so that's the kind of area where I'm kind of like, okay, you know what? I'm going to put that one in the back burner for now, and I'll get to that later. But eventually, I mean, if I'm going to experiment with a lot of this, eventually I'm going to have to take one for the team.
Yeah. You know? Wow. Let me ask you, you know, you mentioned your is it your partner, Ken Albala?
Yeah, my teaching partner.
So
yeah,
your teaching partner. You guys have a Taste of Rome workshop now. It's currently sold out, but there is a wait list available. Tell us about that.
So Ken and I decided a couple months ago. I was thinking. I go over to Rome almost every year, and I get a fair amount of email and comments from my readers asking, "Do you have a cookbook? Are you going to teach this? Are you going to teach it in the museums or travel with it?" And I thought, that's a great idea. And so I spoke to Ken Albala, Dr. Albala, about it, and said, would you like to do this with me? Because this is he's been doing this for a very long time. And I thought, you know, we could do this together for people in Italy, or for people that want to fly there for a week and do it. And he said yes, and I was very happy. And so basically we have put together a program that starts in the late Republic and goes all the way through to the modern era. So it's a history of Roman cooking in 7 days that starts, you know, in the late Republic, goes all the way through to the Empire, to the Middle Ages, the Arab expansions, through to the Renaissance, you know, and then into the modern era when tomatoes made their way over from the Americas. And so it should be a lot of fun. We are sold out. There is a waiting list. But I also, I am going to be doing, I think, one or two day-long classes and tours in mid-July myself, and that just popped up the last week.
Oh,
so
okay.
There should be something on my site about those in the next week or so.
All right. And we have a link on our Facebook page with all your information so people can check that out if they want to get on the wait
list.
And that's all right there. It just sounds like really fascinating stuff. What are you looking forward to? I mean, do you discover more as we go on? Is there new things that you're discovering every day?
Absolutely. I mean, I read a lot. I read all day long, and I study the archaeology and read a lot of the recipes and look into the old Latin texts and stuff. There's so much more to explore. And, I mean, just Rome itself, that's just a very small part of it. There's other parts of the Mediterranean and other parts of the world as well that have their own rich, rich food histories and food culture. Egypt, Greece, Mesopotamia, the Middle East, like the Levant. I mean, you could go all the way back to the dawn of agriculture and have a lot of fun there, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm starting right here, and then I'll probably spend the rest of my life branching out. I enjoy this very much. And I think what I find to be the most joyful about it is the amount of people that are taking an interest in it as well. The amount of people that are interested in coming to this workshop or that write in and, you know, ask questions or come up with their own theories. Like a lot of my readers on Facebook come up with their own ideas on like how this bread was made in Pompeii, and this baker, Jeff from Michigan, he baked his own version of it and said, I think it was made like this. And it's stirring up interest in people with respect to food origins, and it's getting people into their kitchens. It's getting them rolling up the
sleeves. That's great.
And hopefully, you know, their families are doing it with them.
That's great. That's great.
Connects us again to our food.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think this is so interesting and so cool. Let me ask you this before we let you go, Pearl. Do you bring strange things to potluck?
No, but I will now. I certainly will now.
Yeah, because
maybe I'll bring brains to my next potluck.
There you go. That's it. You got to be the standout.
I won't tell anyone.
No, just exactly. Well, Farrell, listen, it was really fascinating talking to you, and we have a link on our Facebook page with all your information, and you can read all about it, check out the recipes, and I think it's great what you're doing, Farrell. So, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Nick. Take care.
Bye. There you go. There's Farrell Monaco, everybody. And we have a link on our Facebook page to her blog where you can get all that information. Really fascinating stuff and very cool. Okay. We'll take a break. We got the news coming up next right here on 720 WGN.